A decade after 9/11, America has certainly changed, but the Muslim world has changed as well. It is a wider, more diverse, more questioning world inspired by a new generation of hip-hop artists, poets, feminists, human rights activists, TV imams, comic book creators, and comedians. It is driven by much of the same technology and social media as the West, cell phones and YouTube, Twitter and Facebook, but hardly a caricature of the West. Up to two-thirds of the baby boom generation of that region are under the age of 30 and hardly content with the culture of Al-Qaeda and its remote video communiques or the messages they embrace. Joining us now is Robin Wright. She's a journalist, author, and foreign policy analyst and expert. During her career, Robin has reported from more than 140 countries on six continents and for outlets including the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the New Yorker. Her awards include the UN Correspondents' Gold Medal, the National Magazine Award, and the Overseas Press Club Award for Best Reporting in Any Medium, requiring exceptional courage and initiative. Her most recent books are The Iran Primer, Power, Politics, and U.S. Policy, and Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. She'll be speaking at Ohio Wesleyan University on Tuesday, March 27th at 7 p.m. You can learn more about that at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, Robin Wright.
I'm so glad to be with you.
You predicted in 2008 that the Middle East was on the verge of massive change. What spurred that prediction at that time?
The thing that struck me so much now 4 years ago was how much the culture of change had begun to transform the region. You had a kind of perfect storm with the demographics of the young. As you pointed out, two-thirds of 300 million people are under the age of 30. And you had at the same time this confluence of whether it was the new hip-hop music giving a means for a voice, particularly for the young, the rise of the new Muslim comedians who introduced not only the idea of humor, but the idea of challenging, ridiculing, skepticism, cynicism of politicians, of political systems, of extremists, saying things that they might not be able to say in a political statement. Whether it was reality contests in which people used poetry to express themselves, that across the board you had playwrights and documentarians and artists of all kinds giving voice to this growing restlessness and frustration, whether it was with the dictators who had ruled for decades or the extremists who had provided the only alternative for so long. And in this joint challenge, they began to shake up the political environment, which we saw explode just over a year ago.
And as far as the cultural revolution, such as it is, the confluence of those things, that had not occurred before. Was it this groundswell of youth that brought it out?
That was one of the facilitators. I think one of the things that's so interesting is to try to look back on what are the instruments that change the mindset of people. And one of the most important was the beginning of communications, media that were outside state control in virtually every one of the 22 Arab states and in many of the 57 Islamic nations. You had a government that controlled whether it was radio, television, magazines, newspapers. And when Al Jazeera was born in 1996, it circumvented state control in a language everyone in the region understood, and it began to cover local issues, national issues, regional issues from their own perspective. And that then gave birth to others. And today you have over 500 independent television stations, satellite television stations in the region. And it's introduced not only a broad array of, whether it's religious programs or political programs or music programs, but it's also introduced the idea of diversity, that there is not just one path, one way, whether it's to find God or to be a good public citizen. And that has then, in this last generation, created people who were born with a sense that there are different ideas and there are different ways to accomplish things.
My guest is Robin Wright, veteran journalist and the author of Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. She'll be speaking at Ohio Wesleyan University on Tuesday. You can learn more about that at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Robin Wright, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Robin, you wrote in the foreword of your book, Rock the Casbah, that during your travels for that, you were struck by the disparate range of political rebellions. You said they fall into three broad categories. One was Arab revolts.
Well, the Arab revolts are what we've witnessed over the past 15 months with the challenge to dictators who'd been in power in Tunisia first, and then Egypt, Libya, and then Yemen, today Syria, and pockets of unrest elsewhere. It's interesting that the first four countries that witnessed change, the leaders, President Ben Ali of Tunisia, President Mubarak of Egypt, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and President Saleh in Yemen, together had ruled in just four countries for a total of 129 years. That's just a staggering statistic when you think about it. And
in just four countries, right?
In just four countries. And you can imagine if you started adding the 40 years of the Assad dynasty, father and son from Syria, that in Bahrain, the prime minister has been in power for over 40 years, that in most of these countries, there is no prospect of change, in part because the same leaders have been there for so long. And so this is one of the common denominators. And it's really interesting that whether they are military dictatorships or monarchies, or whether they're traditional tribal societies or oil-rich sheikdoms or dirt-poor countries, that in each one of them, the common denominator is the fact that these uprisings began in the world's most volatile region using peaceful civil disobedience. And that reflects the profound transformation that's happened across the region.
That's part of that counter jihad,
which is
one of the three categories. Tell us about that. It's an interesting concept that I don't think a lot of Americans were aware of after 9/11.
Well, I think really in the past decade, you've seen a growing sense of fury among Muslims at extremists. Because as many of them have learned painfully, these groups, whether it's Al-Qaeda, its franchises, or some of the others, are very good at destruction, but they don't offer constructive alternative solutions to the problems of daily life, be it healthcare or education or jobs. And in the meantime, far more Muslims have died at their hands, the extremists' hands, than have Westerners. We lost just under 3,000 on 9/11. I had a neighbor who was lost in Washington, and I had two friends in New York. And I lived in Beirut for 5 years when I witnessed the very first suicide bombings. And the contrast is that there are well over 10,000 Muslims who died at the hands of suicide bombs and other explosives across the Arab world. And so there's this growing anger, fury, and we saw it play out, interestingly, in Iraq, where in 2007, it was the local Sunni population, angry at their own loss, that mobilized an opposition force to fight Al-Qaeda. A tribal leader whose father and two brothers had been killed by Al-Qaeda mobilized other tribal elders, and together they managed to put together a militia of over 90,000 men who then fought Al-Qaeda out of Anbar province. It was the most volatile corner of Iraq, and that opened the way for the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The third broad category was rebellion against Islamic ideology, and that is not to be confused with a rejection of Islam.
That's right, and it's played out very vibrantly in a place like Iran. In 2009, Iran had a presidential election in which many expected the two opposition candidates to do fairly well, and one potentially to even win. And when the government announced the results, they were overwhelmingly in favor of President Ahmadinejad, a very controversial character. Millions of people took to the street, and they were challenging not only the election, but the only country in the world that is ruled by clerics, the only modern theocracy. And it was a challenge to the whole idea of an Islamic republic that gives its emphasis or priority just to religion and doesn't do enough in guaranteeing the rights of its citizens in a republic. And so this whole debate over what is an Islamic republic and what to do about Iran's form of government really was put on the table for the first time in a way that was visible, in which we, in the outside world, had a sense there were vast numbers, potentially even somewhere near the majority, challenging the government. Now, the government managed to put it down, but the fact is that everyone knows that that story is not over.
You were there 1979-1980 when they overthrew the Shah.
I've been covering Iran since 1973, and I've been there almost every year since then.
But you weren't there in a couple years ago.
I was in Iran in the run up to the election. Okay. I have not been there since the election.
What, from what you could see, and we could see actually quite a bit because of social media, what were the differences between 1979 and the latest?
Well, in 1979, there were millions again who turned out on the streets of Iran and other cities because they wanted to end a form of rule that had prevailed for 2,500 years. And the 20th century, in many ways, when you look globally, was about transferring power from autocrats to the population, the end of monarchies, the end of empires, and Iran's revolution was part and parcel of that. In the first year, even though there was a sense that this was a country that was going to be an Islamic republic, that the technocrats were really going to rule. But as they got down to writing the Constitution and figuring out what the new order was, there was a growing friction among the very diverse political groups that had joined together on the streets to oust the Shah. And the clerics then came back into the political scene and said, look, we need Islam, we need Muslim overseers. We need clerics who will ensure that this political backstabbing is held in check. And so to Iran's current constitution, which is based, ironically, largely on French and Belgian law, they added a whole layer of Islamic institutions. And that's the moment at which the clerics began to hijack the revolution. And today you see the winnowing of power among the elected officials and the growing power of those who run the Islamic Republic.
My guest once again, Robin Wright, veteran journalist and the author of the book Rock the Kasbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Checking the weather forecast for central Ohio, mostly sunny today, and a high of about 84 degrees expected. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low of 63. Tomorrow, the fun begins. Showers and thunderstorms, a high of 77. The low tomorrow night, 57. By Saturday, only 68 degrees with a chance of showers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. Behind the news, there are real people with something to say. We bring them to you. Roundtable conversations with coal miners, the out-of-work soldiers, their families, and more. Honest conversations about the issues with the people who live their reality. It's fresh perspective you won't hear anywhere else. Join us for the next On Point.
On Point today starting at 12 at 1 o'clock here at 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
My guest is Robin Wright. She's a veteran journalist and the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. If you have a question or comment for Robin Wright, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Robin, we were just talking about those three broad categories that you said encompass the range of political rebellions. And you also said that in each category, those rebellions are far from over.
Yes, we're only at the beginning of a process of change. And I often reflect on what's happened elsewhere in the world over the past quarter century in what was the Soviet Union, which collapsed a generation ago. You still have a former communist and KGB spy chief in power who was just elected or reelected to the presidency and could be in power till 2024. That in South Africa, where I covered the Black Uprising in 1976, and again, Nelson Mandela's walk to freedom 15 years later, the majority of blacks are worse off today than they were under apartheid. The average life expectancy when Mandela was freed was 60 years, and today it's only 41. So this is actually a tangible fact. But the basic problem is that change takes a very long time. And when you look at our own situation, we fought a civil war, and it took, again, almost a century before blacks were really guaranteed the vote in the United States. That, you know, this is, we can't expect that that countries that have been around for thousands of years, such as Egypt, that after only 18 days that the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak is going to introduce a full-fledged and viable democracy. It's not. And this is going to be a roller coaster of a ride, I think, particularly over the next decade. Short term, there are going to be a lot of bumps, a lot of turbulence, arguably greater turbulence than the last decade. But that long term, what's happened in the region is part of this global wave of empowerment we've seen that's transformed the world over the last quarter century.
To what extent will poverty impact the changes in the Middle East, do you think?
That's such a good question, Anne. Frankly, I'm as worried about the economic transformation as the political transformation, because this whole wave of change was ignited by a young street vendor who sold fruit on a corner in a remote city in Tunisia, where I actually went 2 weeks ago to talk to other fruit vendors. And he had been abused by government officials. An inspector demanded a bribe, as often happened. And when he refused to pay, all of his fruit, his little electronic scale, was confiscated from the wooden cart where he sold fruit on the street. And he went from government office to government office looking for someone who would return his fruit. All he wanted to do was work. His concern was less about voting once every 4 years than the simple dignity of being able to support himself. And that's what you find across the region, is this obsession with having a stake in their future, having some control, being able to support themselves. It's, you know, those two classic expressions, it's the economy, stupid, and jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's playing out in the region as well, where there is far greater unemployment today than there was a decade or a year ago when these uprisings began.
You know, it's been said that the economy and the poverty fueled the extremism.
Well, I think there was a frustration that the dictators in the region had been unwilling to allow any center, liberal, democratic, nationalist, even tribal political forces to emerge, that they wanted to monopolize power, and that the only way in some of these countries was to engage in violence. And so I think there was a flirtation or an empathy with some of the groups that were willing to strike out and challenge governments. And but it quickly became clear that they were not going to succeed. And that's when this array of forces in the center, political center, began to decide, we don't want either the extremists or the dictators, and we're going to do something about it. And so many of the phases of activism in the region have been reactive, whether it was to the dictators or foreign intervention and foreign influence, the regional conflict. They were reactions to, you know, forces, an array of forces, that for the first time you're seeing people being proactive. They're saying, we want to seize the initiative in determining our future and not letting others, be they local or international, determine our lives.
Omar in Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Omar.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Ms. Wright. I really appreciate you and your views and your writing as well. I have a question, actually, on the Arab Citizen Revolt. All these peaceful demonstrations and all the changes that happened in the last year or so in the Middle East, that really brought a lot of confusion to the already established stereotype or image of violent Arab Muslims in American media and pop culture. Do you think these millions of people who would demonstrate in the streets would change the image that we have in pop culture in America about Arabs and Muslims, that really these people motivated by their culture and religion to be violent and there's nothing to do but just to go and pound them, basically?
It's probably the beginning of a change in the stereotype Westerners have about Arabs or Muslims generally. Iranians, for example, are not Arabs, and the uprising in 2009 after the election certainly began to change the impression Americans had about Iranians, that there were some out there who wanted the same things we would like to see for them, and that's, you know, a free political system. So I think, yes, is the answer to your question, but I think it's only the beginning of, again, what is likely to be a long process. There is still, a decade after the 9/11 tragedy, extraordinary fear and suspicion. I'm giving 12 lectures in 14 days, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I'm still struck by the deep concern and fear a lot of Americans have about anything that has the word Muslim or Islamic in it. And it's a real tragedy. There are a lot of Americans who don't know, for example, that Islam is a continuation of the monotheistic tradition that began with Judaism and Christianity, that the only woman mentioned by name in the entire Quran is the Virgin Mary. I get Christmas cards every year from Muslims that quote from the Quran about the birth of Jesus, that Muslims embrace Abraham and Moses and Jesus as prophets of or you know, important players in a single religious tradition, and believe that Muhammad was the latest leader of that tradition, with which neither Christians or Jews are going to accept. But the fact is, there is more commonality than a lot of Americans fully understand. And we still have a long way to go to get beyond the kind of cultural difference and perception problems that have characterized the past decade.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you.
Take care. One visual between the late 70s, early 80s in Iran and from a few years ago was women. There were a lot more women involved. And the same thing in Egypt during those demonstrations that were so broadly, that were broadcast so much around the world. How does that change the dynamic?
Well, the two agents of change in the region are the young people and women. And one of the important factors that helped create this confluence or this perfect storm is the fact that the majority of people in the region are today literate, and that includes women. For example, in Iran and Saudi Arabia, over 60% of the students in universities today are women. And that helps change the broader picture of how many activists are there, what are the issues, and the fact that women have been at the forefront of protests, be it in politically savvy Egypt or a country like Yemen, which is the poorest of the 22 Arab countries, really reflects how much has changed. The fact that one of the three Nobel laureates in peace last year was a Yemeni blogger who's only about 30 years old and wears a scarf. She's conservative personally, but very active politically. And she is a reflection of a much broader wave of change, whether it's a million women getting out, signing petitions and marching in Morocco to change certain laws that most affect women's lives, or the fact that an Iranian human rights lawyer won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003, that you've seen over the past decade Muslim women, particularly in the Middle East, coming into their own.
Could there be a backlash? I was wondering if the clerics in control in Iran are thinking about any kind of way to sublimate them. It certainly has been done historically.
Oh, absolutely. And the danger is, tragically, that democracy is not often very good for women. After Hosni Mubarak was ousted in January last year, in early February, that and the military took over. The military actually eliminated the quota that guaranteed women in Egypt had 10% of the seats in parliament. That some of the conservative Islamic parties, particularly one in Egypt, wouldn't allow women who ran for office to have their pictures on the ballot or on campaign. They had showed pictures of flowers or the party logo. This is going to be a rough ride for women, and yet they continue to be outspoken, and they're going through, in some ways, what American women or Western women went through in the aftermath of World War II, when they played a vital role when the men were away at war, and it still took a generation before they began to be major players. There's one little anecdote that's interesting, however. In Tunisia, the first country to undergo an uprising, the International Republican Institute, which is an American group, took a poll last June after its uprising pushed out a man who'd been in power for 23 years. And it asked about one of the proposals for a new constitution that would guarantee that women had 50% of all seats in parliament. This would be the highest quota guaranteed anywhere in the world. And 53% of Tunisians said that was too high. But 41% of Tunisians said it was just right. I'm not sure we'd get 41% in the United States if that was put to a public opinion survey. I mean, we couldn't pass the Equal Rights Amendment, and there are many places that don't offer, equal pay for equal work. And so it's really quite interesting that there is an awareness that women are players.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Robin Wright, veteran journalist and the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. If you have a question or comment for Robin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Will in Columbus, you're on the air with Robin Wright. Welcome to the show, Will.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Appreciate Ms. Wright's reporting ever since the original Iranian Revolution. My question actually on another Islamic country that's kind of going the other direction, and that's Turkey, and on several levels. I mean, women have been more and more wearing the headscarf, and there's been this kind of a conservative movement towards a more Islamic nation, and at the same time, there's been crackdowns on journalists and the press. And you don't read as much about that, but it's kind of worrisome that the original secular Islamic country that divided the mosque and state seems to be going the other direction from several different angles. I just wondered what her thoughts were on Turkey.
It's a good question. And Turkey is arguably the most important of the 57 countries in the Islamic world because it's a place where the Islamic party that now rules and actually doesn't like to call itself an Islamic party, has gone through five different versions. It has moderated in each of these incarnations and confrontations, whether it was with the military or with the constitutional courts that enforce the ban on any religion used in politics. What's interesting about the headscarf issue is that many will tell you, and I've been to Turkey a lot for recently for a project I'm working on, that many will tell you women often wore the scarves before. They just weren't as willing to come out in public, that since the Islamist Party won office, they have been willing to kind of integrate in more public ways. Now, I don't know that there's any poll or evidence that can prove that true, but your general point is true, that across the region, that women are increasingly wearing headscarves. And in Egypt, 40 years ago, virtually no women wore what's called hijab, a kind of scarf that covers the hair. Today, over 85% of women do. But it's not an issue about fundamentalism or piety. It's often an issue of identity. And that during this kind of tumultuous change, a lot of women are trying to create space for a bigger role, whether it's in a job outside the home or some kind of political role, or in many countries, standing in the forefront of the demonstrations.
Well, I was wondering, though, on the governmental end of it, as much as the women's end of it, this Gulen movement and the fact that, you know, that journalists are being intimidated and arrested. I mean, things that you wouldn't have heard about as much 10 or 15 years ago in Turkey. And
well, absolutely you would have heard 15 years ago about the way that any government was tough on the press. I mean, Turkey has been light years ahead of many other Muslim countries, there's no question. But whether it's the current government and its crackdown, which is of deep concern, this is a country that many had looked on as a potential model for the Arab world, and the fact that it is regressing in important ways on a key issue like freedom of speech, bearing down on its critics in the media, is of concern across the board. But it's not like that there was a free press or uninhibited press in Turkey before this party took office. And in fact, the current government has done more than any of the secular parties, ironically, to meet the requirements for Turkey to be a member of the European Union, whether it's on human rights issues or on basic economic measures. So it's deeply flawed and in some ways, as I said, regressing. But it's not like its predecessors were wonderful democratic governments either.
Thank you, Will.
Fight that to some extent?
Sorry, Will?
Yes, I was just wondering whether the same kind of youth movement with social media and so forth has been trying to counter that in any ways, or are they just accepting that the crackdowns that have occurred? So, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks, Will.
Mm-hmm. I think everywhere we're finding in the world, whether it's the Islamic world, and of course Turkey's not an Arab country, or a Persian country like Iran is, that everywhere we're seeing, not just in the Middle East or not just in Islamic countries, the use of people power. We've seen it in Moscow in the challenges to Vladimir Putin in the run-up to his re-election as president. We've seen it in Greece in response to the austerity movement, that whether it's Occupy Wall Street, that we're seeing in of the full array of countries, a sense that the use of the social media is the way to get out and protest, that street demonstrations are a way of drawing attention to a cause. And so I think it's true in Turkey, but I don't want to make it seem as if it's only that part of the world where this phenomenon has happened. I think in the early 21st century, we're seeing this use of people power in vibrant ways in a far greater cross-section of countries than ever before.
And given that the demographic breakdown, youth are at the forefront of that.
Well, they are, particularly in the Middle East, because mm-hmm. it's the world's largest proportionate baby boom.
Right.
And I'm a baby boomer in the United States, and I know how much my generation has influenced everything, you know, whether it's legislation or employment patterns or consumer goods, that a baby boom defines a lot of what happens for the next 30 or 40 years. And that's true in the Middle East, in part because those who are now 20 and 30, or let's say mid, 15 to 30, will control a lot of what happens for the next 30 or 40 years, because the demographic, the birth rate has now come down. It's decreasing in the region. And so there won't be the numbers to overwhelm this generation down the road. And they will be important players. And that's why I say this is the beginning of a process of change that'll follow that baby boom generation as it ages and becomes even more important in defining whether it's a new political order or developing the economy or its relationships with neighboring countries, whether Israel or the Europeans and the United States even.
My guest, once again, Robin Wright, veteran journalist and the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. She'll be speaking at Ohio Wesleyan University next week. If you want more information about that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides and get to a link there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up next hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher, the art of songwriting in Central Ohio. Ann's guest will be Eric Nesda, who is a musician and also head of Nesda Communications, along with local musicians Al Smith and R.J. Cowdery. That's the next hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher. As far as the weather goes, well, enjoy it while you can. Or while you may, I guess is better grammar. Sunny skies today with a high of 84 degrees. Tonight, the clouds roll in. The low temperature will be about 63. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms, a high of 77. Friday night, more showers and thunderstorms, a low of 57. And by Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a high of only 68 degrees. So reality comes back to Central Ohio. Right now, we have 64 degrees at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
While listening to music, a neuroscientist once asked himself the question, where do goosebumps come from? And then, what's going on in my brain that allows goosebumps to happen? Tomorrow night on WOSU-TV, watch a group of researchers as they investigate music's fundamental physical structure, biological, emotional, and psychological. It's The Music Instinct, Science and Song, tomorrow night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Robin Wright, veteran journalist and the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. If you would like to speak with Robin, you have a question or comment for her, you're welcome to the show, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You say, and I think this is a really interesting distinction, that for the majority of Muslims, the central issue is not a clash with other civilizations, but instead a struggle within the faith itself to rescue Islam from a small but virulent minority.
Absolutely. I think we're at an important juncture in the evolution of the faith itself and how people look to it as a means to an end, not the end goal itself. In other words, using the values of the faith to try to create a new order in the same way Judeo-Christian values influence American thinking on our political system. And the goal is not necessarily to create a new theocracy. And when I mentioned the young fruit vendor in Tunisia who set himself on fire, his goal was not to kill anyone else. It was to shame his own government. And he was willing to pay the price, again, not to hurt others, but to say, this is how desperate I am. And that's a turning point that is as important to the faith and the use of the faith as it is to the political environment in that part of the world. So what we're seeing play out has much broader implications for Muslims as well as for Arabs, their, in terms of their point of identity, what it is that gets them to challenge the system, what gets them to rise up. And it also affects their goals, again, not to create an another Islamic Republic or as in Iran or another religious monarchy as in Saudi Arabia. They're really looking for something quite different.
Amado in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Are you there? Amado?
Yes, Amado, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm from a developing country. I will say it's 80% Muslim population. Thank you for discussing that difficult subject, I will say complex subject. You talked about Tunisia and you talked about Egypt. I'll see two different countries. Tunisia, much modern, much westernized even before this revolution. Education level is much different than many other Muslim countries. So I have a difficulty understanding when we say for in Egypt they now giving 10% of the seat to women. I think the real problem in this country, in our countries, is first the education, because it's women themselves who vote for other men, and instead of voting for women who will defend their rights. Do you think the solution will be, instead of saying, say, 10% or 50%, get women to have the same chance in education with men? In that case, then they will be more open to support the ideas, will defend their rights.
I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but I do think that some of the social circumstances and conditions for women are really what's often important in making them more important players. And that's why I think literacy and education has played such an important role in helping women create a separate identity that is not dependent on the main man in their life, be it their father, their husband, their brother, or their son. And education has also helped women look at, you know, what are the alternatives to a rich life? Understanding that perhaps having fewer children will give her more of an opportunity to develop her own professional aspirations or play a role that is more active, whether it's as a volunteer in neighborhood groups, helping create a new civil society, which is so important to healthy democracies. So the social circumstances are also the kinds of things that motivate women to get out on the streets, things like what are called family laws that have to do with the right of divorce or custody and influence the status of a woman so much more than just an election for parliament every 4 years.
Pretty much the way it evolved in the United States.
Well, exactly. And I think we've also reached a point, and I remember this in my lifetime, where women for a long time relied on male legislators to change conditions for women. And then they realized, wait a minute, they're not going to give it to us. They're not going to help us as much as they should. We need to run for office and begin changing things ourselves. And that was a fundamental turning point in the 60s and 70s in the United States. And we're reaching that point, whether it's in Iran or the Arab countries, that women are playing much more vibrant roles. In fact, I was struck when I was in Egypt in January, I interviewed a couple, a husband and wife, who both ran for parliament on a Muslim Brotherhood ticket. And when I interviewed them, they talked about the very different positions they had on various political issues having to do particularly with women's rights.
Thanks, Amado, for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation. We have a few more minutes. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest, once again, Robin Wright, author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. An email from Cynthia. She says, unfortunately, I have been able to listen to only bits of this radio program, which is fascinating. Thank you, Cynthia. What are the similarities between our Western culture and their culture and the similarities with the religions? I was surprised to hear the Virgin Mary is in the Quran. It is apparent that Americans are extremely limited in their knowledge of this culture, and many of the issues are with the extremist groups, which needs to be separated big time from the rest of the Muslims living here and elsewhere. Robin Wright?
Well, look, there are some very basic similarities, and that's true of, I think, the human species, and that is that we all want to feel that if we're sick, there's somebody or someplace we can go and get attention, and that that healthcare is decent in any country. We all want to feel that we have a right to education and to better our lives through that education, that we have access to decent education. So when it comes to the kinds of things people want in their daily life, even, you know, the pickup of garbage, this is one of the things that I've often said, that the new Islamist parties that have won in the Middle East are going to have to deal with the tough realities. How do they create jobs? How do they guarantee that the garbage is going to be picked up at least once a week? How do they provide clean water and make sure that, you know, there are enough doctors or hospitals or clinics to serve populations that are mushrooming? These are the real challenges. And in that way, we don't differ. And that's this frustration with the fact that the dictators were increasingly taking national wealth for their own pockets is, again, a common denominator in the uprisings, that people want a sense that they can vote for other parties, other ideas. There is this sense of wanting diversity in society, wanting choice. And that's the way we're the same worldwide. I think also in this globalizing era, the fact is that so many people want to be a part of it, and they know they're going to be left out in lots of other ways if they're not, if they can't play the same game, whether it's on the economic front or the social front. And so these are the kinds of basic common denominators in the early 21st century, where people also, because they're literate, because they have access to the Internet, know what's happening elsewhere in the world. And they say, hey, you know, I want the same thing. So we're not all that different. And I've been covering, you know, the world for now 40 years, and I am struck in all 143 countries where I have lived and worked, that at the end of the day, there are more similarities than differences, even where the faith is different, the ethnic identity is different, and the history is really different.
President Obama turned U.S. policy on its ear last year when he abandoned Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, an ally of three decades. You include that period among four seminal turning points of the past century in the Middle East. That's pretty profound, and I was wondering if you're confident that U.S. foreign policymakers in general are adequately aware of these cultural shifts behind the Arab Spring, if you want to call it that, or whatever changes you've been predicting since 2008.
Well, what I talked about when I mentioned four turning points were really the fact that in the last century, whether it's the collapse of the Ottoman Empire after World War I, mm-hmm. which created the modern states, or the creation of Israel after World War II, which redefined conflict and security in the region, or the introduction of Islam during the Iranian Revolution as a modern political form of governance. Those are the three turning points. The uprisings were the third. The U.S. policy part of it is not one of the four turning points,
okay.
But it is in many ways a response to what we saw play out in the region. And I do think, in terms of the last 60 years, it is arguably the most profound change we've ever made, because for 60 years, both Republican and Democratic administrations had tried to create stability in the region, in part because of everybody prefers calm over turmoil, and we also particularly want a stable environment in regions that provide a basic source of energy that fuels our industry, our economy, the heat in our homes, and so forth. And so in that part of the world, we kind of had an exception when it came to policy. We gave preference to stability over the values of our own country. And last year, over an 11-day period, President Obama walked away from that policy, largely in response to what was happening on the ground, but also only in part of the region, so that the United States has endorsed the rise of democracy across North Africa, in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt, and into the Arab heartland with Syria. But we kind of come to a screeching halt when it comes to countries like Saudi Arabia and the other oil-producing sheikhdoms of the Persian Gulf, because we still want stability, particularly at a time of economic turmoil worldwide. we don't want to see the rise of the price of oil, which is rising rapidly anyway. And the idea of having turmoil in Saudi Arabia, which is has one of the worst human rights records in the world, but is a very important ally on oil, you know, we're just not willing to take that bold a stand or do much in prodding the Saudis to recognize the realities that are happening elsewhere in the region.
Well, of course, it's not coming from internally either from Saudi Arabia, or it doesn't appear to be.
I actually think that there are lots of forces of change. The average age in Saudi Arabia is 26. Mm-hmm. The average age of the cabinet minister in Saudi Arabia is 65. The king is 87. His heir apparent just died at the age of 83. And the heir apparent, the crown prince, is currently, or was until recently, at the Cleveland Clinic. And he's in his late 70s. And so we're talking not just about a generation gap, but a two- or three-generation gap. And there's a real unemployment problem in Saudi Arabia. It's 10 to 12% officially. But among the young under 30, it's 30 to 40%. And they're not so happy. And I don't think we're going to see a Tahrir Square like the uprising and the at the epicenter of Egypt in Cairo. But I do think that I was there last year. I do sense that there is a lot of discontent, whether it's among those who are young and unemployed and kind of drifting, or whether it's among women who aren't even allowed to drive. There is a sense that they want more out of life.
Just real quick, we're running out of time, but Al-Qaeda. That a lot of people identify Al-Qaeda with the Middle East, with the Arab world and the Muslim world. You're saying they're not dead, but it's lost its edge.
And I think it's increasingly passe. It has lots of franchises, unfortunately, in Yemen, North Africa, and elsewhere. But the fact is, there is a widespread recognition that Al-Qaeda can't deliver the alternatives and that it is political systems that have to be changed. So I think Al-Qaeda has seen its heyday, okay. But it's still not going to disappear.
Robin Wright, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been great.
Thank you very much.
Robin Wright, veteran journalist and author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. She'll be in Central Ohio coming up next week. If you want to learn more about that, go to WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link there for you. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear the questions you wish you could have asked to people like Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Did it help to hear what your voice sounded like on helium? Did you learn something about your voice you didn't know before?
Yeah, I learned that I don't really need the helium.
Because it's pretty easy to flick that switch and go right up there.
The most interesting people in show business on Fresh Air.
Fresh Air comes your way starting at 12 noon today here on 89.7 NPR News. In the weather forecast, it's a pleasure to read this morning. Sunny skies, a high of 84 expected. Mostly cloudy, though, tonight, and a low of 63. Come Friday, showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow's high, 77. Friday night, showers and thunderstorms to continue. The low down to about 57. And then Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and a high of 68 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio Northern University. Nationally ranked academics and a 94% placement rate are hallmarks of an ONU education. Discover ONU Day is on April 21st. More information at onu.edu.
This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. Next hour on All Sides, the musicians and composing music in Central Ohio.
Stigmatization.
online tutoring based in India is booming.
This is the BBC.
BBC News with Kathy Clugston.